You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, confirmation hearings for Supreme Court nominee Neil Gorsuch are underway. We'll talk to a law expert about the proceedings so far.
First, there's been a lot of attention lately to the issue of the growth of the American prison population, and we've seen the beginnings of some bipartisan efforts to start to reduce prison incarceration rates.
Our next guest says prisons are only part of the story and that we should also be talking about jails around the country. In a recent report, she writes that more and more people are ending up in jail than in the past for lesser offenses and for longer periods of time.
Nancy Fishman joins us now. She's director for the Center on Sentencing and Corrections Project at the Vera Institute of Justice. She's speaking at Beloit College Thursday night at 7:30 at the Richardson Auditorium. Nancy, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks. It's great to be talking to you.
I want to start by defining jail, because a lot of people, and I'll confess I do this too, use jail and prison interchangeably a lot of times.
That is true. I think it's a common misperception, and I think we tend to throw the terms around interchangeably. So jails are locally run facilities, and which means they're run and primarily paid for by county governments. With some exceptions. They hold primarily two populations. The first are people being held pretrial, which means they have been charged with a crime or an offense, but have not been convicted. They are legally innocent. Some jails also hold people who are serving short sentences, usually under 1 year. That means they have been convicted potentially of a misdemeanor or a very low-level felony and have received a short sentence and will serve that sentence in a local facility as opposed to going to state prison. Prisons, whether they be state or federal, hold people who have been convicted of crimes. Jails, you know, a lot of jails hold other sort of small populations, ICE detainees or other federal detainees, people being held for the U.S. Marshals Service, people awaiting hearings on violations, but primarily in jails, we're talking about pretrial and locally in short sentence, people serving short sentences. And I should say that nationally, the percentage, most jails, two-thirds of the people in jail are being held pretrial or legally innocent, and that rate has grown considerably. Used to be that two-third, one-third split used to be reversed about 20, 30 years ago.
And you write that there's been kind of a mission creep and a lot more people are making their way into jail. It's happening more often and they're staying for longer periods of time. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, that is true. I think what's interesting is we all know that nationally crime rates for all kinds of crime have been going down steadily since the 1990s. In addition, arrest rates, that is, you know, arrest rates for crime have been going down as well, but jail incarceration rates have been going up. Let me try and explain that in a different way. In about 1983, for every 100 people arrested, 51 people would be booked into the jail. By 2012, for every 100 people arrested, 95 people were booked.
Wow.
That's a dramatic, dramatic increase. And not everyone booked into jail is coming in based on arrest. There's some other reasons that get people there. But what you're seeing is not a dramatic increase in crime that's leading to the necessity of holding people in jail because of a risk for public safety. You're seeing a change in policy and practice.
So who are we putting in jail now for what kind of offenses that we wouldn't have 20, 30 years ago?
Well, I think it runs the gamut. I think, you know, I work all around the country, and our staff, our people, our Vera team works all around the country with jurisdictions that are really looking into this question. Who's in our jail? Why are our jail populations so high? And how could we do things differently to ensure fairness and safety in our communities? So what you find is that, you know, it never, very rarely used to be the case that somebody for a traffic violation or a misdemeanor or a municipal ordinance violation would end up in the jail. Those folks are now being held, and a lot of them are being held on even small amounts of bail, which they can't pay. Also, you know, what's interesting is that even people charged with felonies, again, these are not people who have been convicted of crimes. They are picked people who have been charged with offenses. They are, we do believe, you know, innocent until proven guilty is the bedrock of our justice system. We're finding that more, that bails, even for felony, people charged with felonies, have gone steadily upward. More people, you know, 20, 30 years ago, even people on felonies, a much larger percentage of them used to be released on their own recognizance with a promise to appear. With the growth of the use of cash bail and the increase in cash bail amounts, what we know about people in jail is that they don't have the money to get out. We don't necessarily know that those are people who are likely to flee the jurisdiction. We don't necessarily know if those people are a risk to public safety. What we know is that they don't have money. And if you have, you are charged with a fairly serious crime, but you have money, and charged with a serious crime, and you have the means to flee the jurisdiction, and you have money, you can still get out of jail. Whereas if you're a poor person charged with a low-level offense, and you don't have money, you're staying there until your case is disposed of.
We're talking to Nancy Fishman from the Vera Institute of Justice, talking about the growing use of jails, misuse of jails in some cases. And Nancy, let's talk about another aspect of the cost here. It's not just bail. In many cases, you write that people are charged to stay in jail.
Yeah. I mean, I think the issue of fines and fees really came to the forefront of the public consciousness with a report that the Department of Justice did on Ferguson, Missouri. But the situation in Ferguson is very common, which is that people, you know, in an effort to pay for very large justice systems, a lot of places, particularly smaller jurisdictions, have turned to fines and user fees. So people can be charged a housing cost, even if they get a public defender, which you are allowed to have a public defender because you're considered too poor to afford counsel. They will also be charged a public defender fee, sometimes also a prosecution fee. There will be other court fines and fees. If they are ordered to get drug testing, they'll have to pay for those. If they're out on electronic monitor, they'll have to pay for those. Those fines and fees add up and end up driving people back into the system so that even people charged with fairly low-level offenses, charged and maybe they've taken a plea, they're going to continue to pay and may find themselves back in jail because they can't pay again and again and again, which, you know, ironically ends up costing the system and making the system bigger and more expensive.
You mentioned efforts to start rethinking how we're using jails. What kind of approaches are showing positive signs?
There are a lot of approaches out there, and I should say that Vera is a partner in an effort funded by the MacArthur Foundation called the Safety and Justice Challenge, which is really looking to change how America thinks about and uses jails. And there are 20 jurisdictions participating in this network right now, and actually another 20 just joined to experiment with small initiatives. And what they're doing is really looking at the system that impacts the jail, the local justice system, and identifying ways of reducing their population. I mean, one of the things, one of the interesting things about jail incarceration is that a lot of the decisions that impact the size of the population in a local jail are made locally. We're not necessarily talking about the need to change state law. We're not looking necessarily to even, you know, to talk about changing federal law or federal policy. These are policy and practice decisions that are made by a range of actors. Now, one of the challenges, one of the reasons why jails get so crowded is that each of these decision makers, whether they be the police, prosecutors, judges, probation, all operate autonomously. They don't report to each other. In many places, they don't coordinate or collaborate. They're not thinking about the local justice system as a system. They're all making decisions independently of each other and unaware of how that's impacting the jail population. And the person who runs the jail, whether that's a sheriff or an administrator, can't shut the door, right? They have to take all comers. And what a lot of places around the country are starting to do is actually sit down and talk to each other and say, who do we actually, how do we want to use our jail? What is the jail for? And what do we have now? And how are people that we don't want to be in there, how are they getting there? So that means we're looking at, one, police looking at who they're arresting versus giving citations. I work in Philadelphia right now, which is part of the Safety and Justice Challenge. And one of the things that they did is change certain low-level offenses from criminal violations to civil ones. So things like having an open container or disturbing the peace, you get a ticket now, like a parking ticket close to, rather than a criminal violation that could ultimately potentially land you in jail. Another big one that I already talked about a little bit is pretrial decision making, deciding who goes into, who has to sit in jail while they're waiting for their case to be disposed of and who can be in the community. And moving away from having money be the decision maker here. You know, a number of initiatives, one, having presumptive release for people with fairly low level nonviolent charges, the use of risk assessment tools, which help inform decision makers, you know, who should be there and who shouldn't, and coming up with alternatives that don't involve money, for example, pretrial supervision, notification systems that remind people to go to court. It turns out one of the easiest ways to address people's failure to appear in court is actually to remind them to show up, either by text or even by snail mail. Prosecutors and courts and others are looking at diversion options, particularly focused on populations with substance abuse issues or mental illness who fill up a lot of our jail beds, coming up with alternatives that address the root causes of the offenses they've been charged with rather than just locking them up again and again and again. So we're seeing in places that implement these kinds of solutions and even looking at how cases are processed, are able to directly reduce their jail population.
And we'll leave it there. Nancy, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks. It's been great to talk to you, and I'm looking forward to my visit to Beloit.
That was Nancy Fishman, director for the Center on Sentencing and Corrections Project at the Vera Institute of Justice. She's speaking on the use and misuse of jails at Beloit College. That's Thursday night at 7:30 at the Richardson Auditorium.
Coming up, we'll talk about the confirmation hearings currently underway for Supreme Court nominee Neil Gorsuch. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.